Good afternoon, I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for What Mama Wants. I think Mother Earth wants far less toxics and more health for her planet. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics, like mercury, PFAS, pesticides, are playing in our daily lives. My guest today is Nick Cherov. He's the president and chairman of Loudoun Trust and Wells Reserve Management Authority. He oversees fundraising, communications, and marketing for the Saltwater Estuary in Wells, Maine. This is Earth Week, and we are talking today about the confluence of conservation and toxics as seen from the office window at the old Loudoun farmhouse. So we are coming up on Earth Day. And here we are at Loudoun Farm Trust, a.k.a. Wells Reserve.
The Wells National Estuarine Research Reserve. It's a long name that we shorten in many different ways. It's nice to be part of a national system of 30 of these places, these National Estuarine Research Reserves, but it doesn't have the same ring as National Park. You know, estuarine is, you know, of an estuary, which then you have to explain what an estuary is, where the rivers meet the sea and waters chemically mix. We go by Wells Reserve. Wellsreserve.org is the website. At Loudoun is the name that locals know because it's been Loudoun Farm since the 1880s or so. But, I mean, it has been a working landscape for, well, 350 years under colonialism and much longer than that, time immemorial before then.
This is one of my favorite places on Earth. I have to self-disclose. I've been here a lot over my adult life, and it feels like a home away from home for me.
It's a beautiful spot. I think unique in Maine, in the Northeast, and maybe even the country. I mean, it's a National Historic Register site with 7 miles of trails, a beautiful wild beach, but also a coastal science research laboratory, education programs, and a staff of probably 20 by this point, 30 in the summer, working on climate change and biological research and environmental education and adaptation to this changing, rapidly changing world.
And on my way in, I passed 3 plein air painters. There's a whole arts culture here as well.
Are they here today too? I thought it might be too windy for them. I suppose I can see a lot more of the buildings because the leaves aren't out yet. Yeah, it's a beautiful, tranquil place. Great place to paint a picture or go for a walk.
And last year, it was the first time you had ever had an artist-in-residence program. And I came to the speakers of that, and I was so moved and wowed. And I thought, oh, even more beauty when you mix the art and the science together.
That's kind of a pet project of mine. I've been in the sciences and science communication my entire almost 25-year career now. And I'm tired of science just trying to communicate science. I mean, scientists are great at doing science. They're not the best communicators, nor should they be. I think artists are incredible communicators. And when you mix the two, you can actually open up new ways of understanding and introduce people who are unfamiliar with either to the other. Having artists in residence here, I mean, like we just said, it's a beautiful place. It's an inspiring place. It's contemplative here. You're surrounded by quiet nature that's constantly inspiring. But there's also a lot of material here. So we ended up having 2 of them. One was a performance artist and the other was a musician. And though the performance artist had been doing a lot of work with climate change, the musician was just here to work on her album, but ended up, I think, having the most moving experience here because of what she was working on.
And I think this beauty transforms you. It reminds you of what you're fighting for. This is a whole intact, multiple intact ecosystems all together.
And it's layered with metaphors, too. I mean, an estuary is where waters mix. It's where right and left, red and blue, can come together as well. You know, we have elevation changes here. You can be down at the bottom of a trail in depression and come out into the sun as well. This musician who was here, she was actually working through the grief of dealing with her mother's Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. just her mother's long goodbye. But as she was here for 10 days talking with our scientists and educators and staff here, I think we all found the parallel to climate grief. I mean, what is saying goodbye to the environment that we've known and grown up in, but a long goodbye, one that is creeping up on us and disappearing every day in small bits and pieces, just like a loved one is to illness. And we can feel powerless about it. That's something that we can't always change or affect because it's bigger than we are, but we can change how we feel about it and deal with it. And that's what the musician, her name is Liz Bills, that's what Liz was exploring through her music and ended up giving us, I guess you heard, just a phenomenal concert in our barn at the end of a 10-day residence. It was just so moving. And I was just emailing with her last week, seeing how she's doing. She's going on tour this summer, still dealing with her mother, still working through a lot of that processing, just like we all are.
Yeah, climate grief. We all know exactly what we're saying with that. Mm-hmm. I recently was talking to a man named Jeff Wax, who worked for the ALDA Center, and he worked with scientists for 1 year, teaching them improv so they could get more comfortable talking about their work.
We are recording this on Earth Week. I just got back from 5 days in California, where I was at a college reunion of my improv troupe. I did improv in college and for many years afterwards, and this was our troupe's 35th reunion. And there was a lot of that, and I was part of a discussion among people in communications talking about how, yeah, I use those skills that I honed messing around in college all the time in communications and telling stories and trying to come up with the best way. And this is, again, using an art to convey the science or even just having a conversation. Improvisers end up being pretty good at it because they're trained to listen, respond, add, and find the interesting kernels, I hope.
I heard a phrase this week that I hadn't heard before, and it was climate pollution. And I love it because it's putting together two concepts. You know, we'll talk about how bad plastics are and microplastics and all the toxics that come with that. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have to connect those things with climate change. Mm-hmm. That's what's driving a lot of the problems. And so I wondered, have you heard this word climate pollution before? And if so, what's it say to you?
I have never heard it before, and yet it resonated instantly. I think that it's a good frame. Pollution, we all understand. We all understand and we all agree that we want a healthy environment. I mean, Republican, Democrat, clean air, clean water, that polls well. And yeah, carbon dioxide is just a byproduct of burning fossil fuels. Plastics are just another form of fossil fuels. It's all this stuff that needs to stay in the ground and not be transmuted into the things that are killing us and just changing our ways of life. I mean, we have better ways. We already do. It's just getting to them. It's not a question of the technology anymore. It's just the will. I think it will be easier if we do talk about it as climate pollution. And we want a healthy climate, an unpolluted one. Makes sense to me.
Makes sense to me, too. I saw online that you have a number of talks that are coming up in May and June. And one was about the changing ecosystem and the warming of the Gulf of Maine, mm-hmm. and what that will mean to crustaceans and the fishing industry as well. Can you say something about what Wells Reserve Estuary Research, Loudoun Trust Farm is doing and thinking about those climate changes?
Yeah, I mean, it's inescapable. It's affecting everything. I was listening to a report on NPR this morning about how melting ice in the Arctic affects California wildfires. And it's one big system that we sort of understand. And so each scientist is trying to work on it in his or her own kind of particular niche. And here at the Wells Reserve, we have been for the past few years, at least, and forgive me, my pandemic time dilation really kicks in here, but we've gotten a number of grants from the National Sea Grant, from the American Lobster Initiative, because what better species to study in Maine than lobster? It is our iconic and most important fishery up here. And we've been working a lot on how lobster larvae, for instance, young lobsters, juveniles, and egg-bearing mothers are affected by warming waters. That's what's happening in our research lab right across the campus here. We ended up, during the pandemic, the New England Aquarium shut down their lobster hatchery, and we brought it up here. It's now in a back building, and it works very well, and we raise thousands of baby lobsters here per year and do experiments on them. And the conclusions are pretty clear. Warming waters stress them out, make it harder for them to move, reproduce, metabolize. And I think if I were them, I would move to cooler waters. And that will initially be deeper in the Gulf of Maine, but ultimately I expect it'll be farther north and out of American waters. And beyond shell rot disease, that's the bigger worry, is that, you know, this fishery may have a lifespan on it. And it's, what, a $2 billion a year industry in Maine when you count to all the landings plus all the serving of it and all the plush lobster toys, apparently, that come with it. I mean, it's big. That's huge for Maine. And we are studying this. And like all science, I mean, it's incremental. We chip away at the monolith of the unknown. But everything that we're finding and our colleagues up and down the coast and around the Gulf of Maine are finding is that this is a rapidly changing body of water, and it's going to have significant effects on the species that are here now and the ones that are coming in.
What kinds of changes have you seen already here on this property? How many acres is Laudholm Farm?
So the Wells Reserve, and this is the Laudholm Farm campus of the Wells Reserve. So this campus is a couple hundred acres. It's where our trails branch out from. But the marshland, the protected areas of the Wells Reserve, stretch from the Kennebunk border all the way down to Ogunquit. And yeah, I mean, over the past few decades, certainly, sea level's rising. The marsh is getting flooded more often. It's degrading faster than it used to, partially, we think, due to green crabs in the marsh. There's just more and more of those than there used to be. Partially due to there's more rain, more freshwater inputs coming down.
And green crabs are invasive species?
They are. Although they've been in the Northeast for hundreds of years, they are. They're still multiplying quite happily and pushing out other species. The rising waters are flooding out probably the next species to go. Is it endangered yet? I'm not sure. I can't remember. But it will soon be, if it's not, is the salt marsh sparrow. It's a bird that makes its nest at a very specific height above the highest high tides, but those are rising. And the marsh is not migrating inland fast enough to keep a zone for that bird above the rising waters. Plus, storms are hitting more frequently. There's more flooding than there used to be due to both rising seas and the expanded water and just stronger storms in general. So all of these things are contributing. Tree species are changing. Spring is arriving earlier. Fall is staying later. There's not as much snow during the winter. Temperatures aside from, what, 2 days this year are not enough to kill the ticks in the wintertime anymore. There's less snow on the coast, but more ice, as we all saw this year. If you look around here, the trees down. I mean, it's changing faster than we can keep up with it. Every year, it seems, we're discovering some new kind of, that didn't used to happen. And if you ask any of the old codgers who are farmers around here, or the people that have been coming here in family cabins for generations, everybody sees this.
It's sobering and scary. And I heard that people have a 5-year memory on weather. And so they kind of forget that spring actually used to come later, or that fall used to start earlier, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is president of Laudholm Trust and Wells Reserve, Nick Cherov. If you go to wellsreserve.org, you can learn about the stunning array of offerings, including lectures, guided tours, festivals, yoga, art, summer camp, And the list goes on and on. It's really quite remarkable.
This place is a place to discover. There's always something going on here, always more to learn. So wellsreserve.org, just the short name, wellsreserve.org is the place to go to come discover this place with us.
This is a show about toxics. And here at Wells Reserve, you're a little more focused on research and community building. But how do toxics intersect with the work you're doing here?
Well, I do like to point out that we're right next to the Rachel Carson National Wildlife Refuge. And when we lead people out on kayak trips, we inevitably see raptors of all sizes and shapes, harriers and red-tailed hawks and bald eagles, ospreys. And we see so many of them because of Rachel Carson and the work she did to raise awareness. And so toxins in the environment are beatable. We don't have to live with them. There are success stories out there. It's a good reminder that if citizens and government, citizens pressuring government, when that happens, industry has to follow and we can make change, the change that we want to see. PFAS are the next big thing. And Fred Stone is right up the road in Arundel. We are just beginning to understand the level of PFAS in the environment. I think if we look for them, we're going to find them. And by we, I mean as a society, not the Wells Reserve. That's not our bailiwick. If it were, I know we would be busy for years.
I had a friend go to an Earth-based meeting recently, and they said, wow, poor Maine, you all have a real big PFAS problem. She goes, it's a testing question. Yeah. And you test, you'll find it too, because all 50 states have spread sludge, and just ours has stopped. So yeah. Go Maine.
Yeah. No, we're doing the right things. We saw the problem, quickly stopped. And now we're going to be finding them everywhere. I grew up cooking on Teflon. I'm sure you did too. And sometimes, you know, the little bits and pieces got scraped off because somebody used a metal spatula instead of a rubber spatula. And if only we had known, if only DuPont and 3M and the companies that were making these nonsticks had shared their internal data with the world. But isn't that always the case? So
it makes you kind of wish there were a regulating body.
It makes you kind of wish that our political system was not so beholden to money and the powerful. But again, it doesn't have to be. Change can happen very rapidly in this world. And that's why, to me, the greatest toxin out there is still carbon dioxide and methane, the greenhouse gases, because they're going to do the most damage globally. Those can be regulated. Those can be taxed. And we know how to do that. There are other places that are doing it, trying it out. It's just a question of will. I think we've got this. I'm typically a pessimist by nature, but people were asking me, you work in the environment, what do you think about climate change? I said, we've got this. We've got this thing. We will solve this, partially because we have to, because it's existentially debilitating for us as a civilization, but also because we know how. And imagine the world that we get if we do all the things, you know, running everything on clean electricity. There's more energy from the sun than we can ever hope to use as a planet. It's fine. We can get there. It's just the will, and the will that is just constantly, even if there's a lot of will by the people, entrenched, moneyed interests, they have some good capitalistic momentum that will be hard to turn. But we'll have to.
But we did it before. You know, I think about the beginning of Earth Day, and there had just been a giant oil spill in California.
Oh, yeah.
And there had been the Cuyahoga River on fire. Mm-hmm. All over the place, there were major just pollution, just dumping into rivers. I think you could kind of walk across the Androscoggin on all the trash and bubbling things. Absolutely. So it's so much better because Earth Day triggered then the clean air and the clean water.
The Coastal Zone Management Act, which created the Wells Reserve, among the other 29 reserves. It's like, you know, people say, oh, Nixon did the EPA. It's like, well, the people pushed Congress and the Nixon administration to do all these things. The Endangered Species Act, one of the most powerful pieces of legislation that we have. clean air, clean water. Absolutely. These are all possible with real pressure. What can people do? They can just write and tell their elected representatives that they care about these things. I was in Washington, D.C. back in March on a trip to Capitol Hill, and Capitol Hill staffers continue to say, we read letters. We answer them all. If we get 10 letters on a subject from a district, we know that it's important because it takes a lot to write a letter. Like emails, tweets, shares on Facebook, not the same. But a letter, somebody sitting down, typing out or handwriting out a letter, it matters to people. And those things just need to keep happening. And so, you know, write your congresspeople. Marches are good too. I was in a climate march down in D.C. while I was there, and, you know, 10 feet away from Bill McKibben. And there's a few hundred people on a Tuesday afternoon marching down to the banks and demanding that they divest from oil companies. And it's like, that will continue to happen and needs to happen more.
Oh, yes. And if you're listening in Maine, this is a really important week. The legislature is meeting on all kinds of important bills around PFAS and whatnot. And if you care, you can write a letter to the editor this week. You can write your senators and congresspeople this week. And you can go testify in Augusta this coming week. So if that's not something you've done before and it's something you want to do, contact your favorite nonprofit that does advocacy and they'll show you how. I know that Maine Women's Lobby is having a letter writing lesson, kind of everybody get together and write letters about things that are important to you. So please, you love something dearly and want to protect it, this is a good week for it.
It's so easy now. I mean, if the pandemic did one thing right, it ushered in the era of just video conferencing is actually possible now. You can give testimony to Augusta from your living room over Zoom now.
With bunny slippers on.
You don't even have to get dressed up. It's all possible there. And yet, so many hearings are just a few legislators in a room and maybe a few people. And they think that people aren't paying attention, but they are paying attention. It's just, there's so much to pay attention to. But if you keep your eye on the important things, important to you, then there are ways to keep track of these things and get involved and push the needle in the right direction.
So this show's called What Mama Wants, and I like to ask my guests, what do you think Mama wants regarding the health of our climate and our environment? What do you think Mama wants from us these days?
I would think that she would want us to remember what it's like to live in balance. I think we need to look to the original and continuing inhabitants of this continent who did not come up with extractive capitalism, but instead our native peoples, our indigenous leaders, they, for the most part, had societies that knew how to take the gifts and keep them giving. So much of our growth and our economy, it's like it doesn't figure in the costs. You know, we can make things like Teflon and things don't stick to the pans. But if cancer is the cost of that, we should really just let things stick to pans. I think that's a no-brainer, but that's not figured in. If destruction of the coastal towns and cities that, more than 40% of the world lives in, is the cost of burning fossil fuels, maybe we shouldn't burn fossil fuels because they're not nearly as cheap as we think they are. What Mama wants? Mama wants us to understand the entire ledger and to act in that understanding. I think Mama Earth is an accountant as much as a nurturer, and she sees that we are writing checks our butts can't cash.
Yes, living beyond our means is the very definition of unsustainable.
Yeah.
So before we close this, I like to ask my guests a few questions about their personal relationship with the Earth, if you're game.
Sure, sure.
You already said you were into improv, so this should be really fun and easy for you. What kinds of things did you like to do outside as a kid?
I fished badly, would bring home little 3-inch sunfish that I would then ask my mom to kill and gut and pan fry for me, thinking that I was a mighty hunter-gatherer. That didn't last very long. I biked everywhere because I grew up in a rural town. I sat outside, I jumped on a trampoline, I played sports, and I came up to Maine in the summers, and that's why I live here now. I grew up hopping along the back shore of Peaks Island in the summer times off the coast of Portland in Casco Bay, and to me, there's no better place than the edge of the sea to get all the curiosity and wonder of nature in one place. You get all the environments in one place. The coast is a dynamic place that gets flooded twice a day, so the things you find there are always fascinating. And so, yeah, like almost everybody in that I've interviewed across the country and who I work with, it's all formative experiences in nature, just being constantly amazed by what's out there.
Which brings me to the next question. Can you tell us about a time when you have felt genuine awe in nature?
I would be hard-pressed to tell you about a time I don't. I take my dog for a walk almost every morning. We'll do 2 or 3 miles before work, sometimes at dawn in the wintertime, because dawn is 7 o'clock. But certainly this year, walking in the snow, while the snow was falling through local land trust properties, and thinking that he and I are the luckiest creatures alive to be able to see this, like snowflakes are landing on his tufty eyelashes, and I'm just looking at him going like, you are a marvel. And he is looking at me saying, I want a treat. And the two of us are just having the best time. Is that all? I don't know. I'm so happy and at peace. And when I get back in from a walk, I'm more creative, I'm more energized. And that is not a coincidence. That's how we evolved. And that we did that along with 10 million other species all at the same time. And that it all tends to work if we don't screw it up. That's a source of constant admiration and amazement and wonder.
Speaking of wonder, what's something that you're currently wondering about in nature?
I mean, right now, spring is the time for, like, how do things know when to turn back on? Why do the buds come back in the same shape? I was looking at a bud identification guide the other day, and how even in the wintertime, you can tell by the scars of the leaves that had fallen off in the fall what kind of tree it is. And so everything has its own distinct fingerprint out there. And I guess, of course, it does. But that we know that, and that we've known that for such a long time, is like somebody has wondered before me, and that I can wonder and look these things up is just great.
That's very cool. And the final question is, what's your favorite baby animal?
I'm thinking really hard about this one because, of course, any parent would want to say their children. But I have teenagers now. I think elvers, glass eels, are just beautiful and alien. I think baby lobsters are really neat, that they start up as these little tiny, like, floating just crabs and turn into that cockroach of the sea. There are cute baby animals. There are bizarre baby animals. There are so many baby animals that look just like baby humans at the fetal stage that, you know, I really think that more people should look at that and say, wow, we are all of the same. Us vertebrates, anyway. I don't know. I don't think about baby animals nearly enough, I guess.
Well, give it some thought. You can come on again and tell me your favorite baby animal. There are a lot of baby animals walking around on the property today because everybody's on school break and their moms with kids on the front pack and the backpack and the strollers. It's a pretty impressive turnout today.
I just came back from a vacation where I was hanging out with a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old. They're cute. Absolutely. Yeah, they can stay.
Nick Charov, thank you so much for your time today and for joining me on What Mama Wants.
Hey, anytime. Love to chat.